Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Hey, Sound Opinions listeners, if you support us on Patreon, you get to listen to our podcast ad-free on Patreon.
You're listening to Sound Opinions, and this week we're going to do a genre dissection on the 80s psychedelic rock scene in Southern California, the Paisley Underground. I'm Jim DeRogatis.
And I'm Greg Kot. We'll also explore the origins of the Shangri-La's influential song, Leader of the Pack. But first, some new music from the Hives. A little bit of Bogus Operandi from The Hives' new album, The Death of Randy Fitzsimmons. I love how that song opens. Oops, overslept.
Again.
So, basically their tongue-in-cheek attitude towards, this is the first album in, what, 11 years from The Hives, right? The Swedish pop garage rock band just blew up in the early 2000s, late 90s. Part of that wave of garage rock bands, you know, this was sort of the Swedish response to what was going on in places like New York City at the time.
Yeah, you know, the Strokes and the White Stripes. Right. I love all that 2000s nostalgia. Yeah.
So there was a whole nest of those Swedish garage bands, you know, Soundtrack of Our Lives and a few others. But the Hives were the ones that sort of poked through the surface with Main Offender. That was was an actual hit. And it was great. And seeing them live and documenting their records defined that sound for a new era. Great sense of humor, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, you got three chords, you got skinny pants, and you got humor. You got this genre of music.
Well, part of the humor extends to Randy Fitzsimmons.
Right. Well, we should point out, who is Randy Fitzsimmons? This was sort of like a Nanker Felge type of, you know, creation. Designed to hide someone who was actually writing the songs. Randy Fitzsimmons was credited many times in interviews by the band as being the Svengali, the guy, the behind-the-scenes guy that basically put together the band, wrote all the music, etc.
Manager of the
right?
band, yeah.
But, I guess the NME did some digging back about 20 years ago and said, it's actually the guitar player of the band.
Yeah.
He just didn't want his name out there. But whatever the case may be, they use this sort of, idea of Randy Fitzsimmons being resurrected or finding the tomb of Randy Fitzsimmons after he allegedly died. And, you know, we opened the casket to find what was in there. Lo and behold, it was a bunch of songs that we have to record.
Yeah, after 11 years not recording.
So as you can tell, these guys love to have fun. And that's what's been the case all along. This is their sixth studio album, but first in 11 years. The Hives, the death of Randy Fitzsimmons. We're going to play a song from it before we review it. It's called Trapdoor Solution.
Trapdoor Solution from the long, long-awaited new album by The Hives, The Death of Randy Fitzsimmons. Greg, there is no death on this album in terms of the music and the attitude. It is pedal to the metal, straightforward garage rock. Reinventing the wheel? No. But I think The Hives are up there with the Fleshtones as two of the greatest garage revival bands that we've seen since the original garage rock Nuggets era of 1966. One of the things that makes the tracks that the great Lenny Kaye chose for that Nuggets compilation, which was really the starting point of let's rediscover garage rock and now three revivals or so at least, right? Never really went away, but it's been reviving ever since. One of the keys was that there were equal parts. We Want to Be the Beatles, right? Because they're the biggest band in the world. And we love Motown. So that soul, that groove, the best Nuggets bands always had that. The Fleshtones and the Hives always had that. And then there's the just party hardy attitude, you know? That the last song on the album, The Bomb, Howlin' Pelle Almqvist. That's the singer. You know, he says, what do you want to do? Go off. What don't you want to do? Not go off. And that's the whole party, you know? We want to live.
Yeah, it's over the top and fun as heck. Countdown to Show. You can find some really great couplets in almost every song. Just funny, you know, laugh out loud funny. Countdown to Shutdown, you know. And my guy Ponzi, he had a scheme, you know. That was their commentary on economic collapse, woes, inequality, yes. Right, in the country.
My guy Ponzi, he had a scheme, and the world is like a head of hair. Some are waiting for their share. Some are balling with a billionaire.
They don't take anything seriously, least of all themselves. There is a hint of anger and bittersweetness in some of the songs, you know. They are addressing some social issues, but they sound like they're having fun doing all of it. Every one of this is like joyous music played at you know, velocity that rivals what the Ramones did in the 70s, right?
Yep.
There's only one real outlier here. You know, there's a couple of tracks you just kind of go, this isn't really their alley. You know, Stick Up has those horns on it, and it sort of has this film noir kind of vibe. I'm not sure that exactly works. They're working with this guy Patrick Berger, this Swedish producer who's worked with people like Robin and Icona Pop, Lana Del Rey, Charlie XCX.
Well, and the footnote I can't resist adding is they recorded this at the studio owned by ABBA's Benny. I love that.
Yeah, so that may explain a track like Stick Up, which is a little bit out of their comfort zone. And
yeah, but it's 2 minutes long,
yeah,
Greg. What are you complaining
about?
Well,
all the songs are, I think 3/4 of the album is under 3 minutes, right?
Yeah.
And then What Did I Ever Do to You, that is the biggest outlier, that sort of creepy spaghetti western reverb-y guitar.
What did I ever do to you?
It comes to like as the penultimate song on the record. You kind of go, what's this doing here? You know, it's kind of like maybe there's a little change of pace. Otherwise, though, it's pure Hives, and it's exactly what you'd expect it to be. It's like a Motorhead or a Ramones record.
Yeah.
You know what you're buying ahead of time, right?
And they haven't lost a step.
Exactly.
Now, let's revisit, Greg, the genre dissection we did a couple of years ago on the Paisley Underground. They're on my mind again. There's a new Rain Parade album, and it's fantastic.
Done to your mind.
In the early 1980s in Southern California, a new interpretation of an old sound was brewing. It was led by four critical bands, the Bangles, the Dream Syndicate, the 3 O'Clock, and Rain Parade. The Paisley Underground was all about reinterpreting those psychedelic sounds from the 60s, influenced by bands like the Beatles and the Byrds, and blending it with a post-punk vibe. They used droning guitars, driving drums, and psychedelic lyrics, very dark psychedelic lyrics, to make an impact on indie rock forever. Even Prince was totally smitten with this sound, working with the Bangles and naming his own estate and record label Paisley Park after that movement. Jim, why don't you set the scene for us?
Early 80s in California, actually the suburbs of Los Angeles, Davis, California. We have this scene come together of a lot of smart, ambitious, hugely talented musicians around a band we won't really talk much about, a group called Green on Red, which in my opinion had more to do with the roots of alt country.
16 kids, 16 ways, they shot my babies by mistake.
They used to have these big old barbecues, okay? And these kids would come. And these kids happened to be members of what would become the Dream Syndicate and the Bangles and the Rain Parade. They all are young, you know, and they are discovering this moment of psychedelic exploration in rock and roll in the mid-60s, 66, 67, 68, largely in Britain, some American bands, and they love this music. They love this idea and this attitude that I can create this thing in the recording studio that transports you to another world that exists only between the headphones, the recording studio as an instrument, psychedelic sounds, more expansive lyrics, the idea of transcending toward the white light.
Turn off your mind, relax, and float downstream. It is not dying. It is not dying.
Well, and don't forget punk too, Jim. I mean, I don't.
Yes.
I think that it has to be said this wasn't just a regurgitation.
No.
Of those bands that they loved in the 60s, but this was the punk thing was happening then, and you know, bands like X. And the Blasters were floating around and influencing the way these bands approach the music as well.
So these kids have this moment. And initially, they're all recording really DIY, really indie, underground. So there is this acknowledgement of the past, and there is this element of fashion. We're dressing like it's 1966 Carnaby Street. the boys and the girls. It was always an equal part male and female movement. Just as every band from Seattle would come to hate the word grunge, the bands in California in 82, 83 is the heyday of Paisley Underground, would come to hate that tag and also love it. I mean, it did some good things, some bad things. Stephen Roback of the Rain Parade told me, you know, that Paisley Underground tag was simultaneously good and bad. It was good because it helped a lot of serious musicians get some notoriety and make good music. But it was bad because there were a lot of preconceived notions about what psychedelia was. I want to start by talking about one record, and then we're going to look at what we consider are the four most important bands. They get together and they cover some of their sacred heroes on a record that comes out in 83, the high point of every one of these bands' careers early on, Rainy Day. And so the Rain Parade, the Bangles, the Dream Syndicate, and the 3 O'Clock get together, swap members, and cover songs that they consider inspiration for this new wave of psychedelic sound. They cover Bob Dylan.
But if I could save you any time, come on, give it to me, I'll keep it with mine.
They covered the Beach Boys, Sloop John B.
Come on, Sloop John B. My grandfather and me. A long lost old town we did roam.
Buffalo Springfield, yeah. Flying on the ground is wrong. Big Star They cover the Velvets. They cover Jimi Hendrix. They're friends having fun, but they're also laying a roadmap for sounds that they thought broke ground in the 60s that no one had followed up, and now we're going to pick up those loose threads. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think there was an innocence there as well. This is a dark time. I mean, we're talking about the onset of the Reagan 80s.
The Reagan era.
We're talking about the Cold War era. We're talking about the nuclear arms buildup. We're talking about a ragingly bad economy.
Yeah.
There was a lot of dispirited people in the youth culture. And I think this music took the brightness and promise of that psychedelia from the 60s and blended it with the punk ethos and created mm-hmm. something that was really unique for its time.
Well, let's take these bands one by one. Dream Syndicate is started by a rock critic, like the French auteur movement of Godard and Truffaut, right? These people who love the art and write about the art and think about the art then decide, hey, I can make some art.
Yeah, well, these were, you know, largely educated people. Their parents inevitably had pretty cool records to listen to, and they were already steeped in art and culture when they started to forge their young adult lives in Los Angeles in the early 80s. You know, Steve Wynn is a great example, the driving force in the Dream Syndicate.
The band name, of course, comes from?
That is Tony Conrad's Dream Syndicate, the experimental yes. musician from the 60s creating this drone music that John Cale was involved with and yes. other early members of the Velvet Underground. And the Velvet Underground was a tipping point band for Steve Wynn. At the age of 19, he heard a Velvet Underground record, the Banana album, the debut record, the Andy Warhol cover of the Banana, and never looked back. He said, this is the stuff, this is what I aspire to.
Well, to use the phraseology, both of the 60s and the Paisley Underground, that he saw God.
Sunday morning brings the dawn in. It's just a restless feeling by my side.
They put out an EP, self-released in 82, got signed to Slash Records, and then released a debut album in 1983 that is considered a real landmark of the genre, The Days of Wine and Roses.
What a record.
That, to me, is a really important document. They had key tracks on that record, Tell Me When It's Over, was the single, and to me that was a great little expression of merging those 60s sounds with the punk sensibility, you know, punk rock songs. This is a different sound that really didn't have a context in that era.
The word from outside is she's on the ledge again, drawing a crowd and threatening everything. I'm here wondering just where I fit in. Everybody says I don't care.
You have to remember, Greg, that shortly after the psychedelic moment, it gets reduced in rock history, the shorthand, to if you're going to San Francisco, wear a flower in your hair, right?
Yeah.
It's all sunny. But there, of course, was dark trip psychedelia from the very beginning.
And I think the band took that as far as it could take it. I mean, it imploded. They only really made four albums in their heyday. You know, the last one was Ghost Stories in 1988.
Yeah.
And like many of the bands from this era, they had this 5-6 year window
yeah.
where there was an incredible explosion of creativity, and then poof, you know, they all kind of disappeared.
Let Professor DeRogatis inform the history for the younger listeners. You know, the magic of the indie rock 80s is that there were no stakes. Right? You were not going to be more popular than selling 5,000 albums, and maybe college radio would play you, and fanzine writers like you in upstate New York or me in Hoboken would write about it. And that was it.
Yeah.
That was superstar success. Every one of these groups gets signed to a major label, which promptly proceeds to jump up and down on their heads and stomp out all originality.
Mm-hmm.
As brilliant as Days of Wine and Roses by the Dream Syndicate is, I would say the one essential album, if you're going to start with one from the Paisley Underground bands and that moment in Southern California in the early 80s, is Emergency Third Rail Power Trip.
I
This is one of those classic bands, the Rain Parade, that had an embarrassment of riches. David Roback is central in the early days, but equally as talented as a songwriter is his brother, Stephen Roback. Ideas are exploding out from these guys in every which way. Like the Dream Syndicate, there's also a dark element to their take on psychedelia, a sort of more meditative, philosophical. I'll tell you, I think what Stephen told me, the state of mind we were in was all really dark. It's the Reagan 80s, right? It was like personal therapy, this music, for the band. Whereas the Dream Syndicate jams tended to be noisy, Rain Parades tended to be very much in that psychedelic drone tradition of almost a sitar. And then you had a wonderful drummer. Each of these bands had great drummers. See, I think the secret of psychedelic rock, as opposed to like psychedelic jam band, man, is that it stays rooted in the rock. You know, there's this thing that's keeping our feet on the ground, even as our head is in the clouds. You hear that in a song like What She Done to Your Mind or Kaleidoscope.
Like a kaleidoscope. Turn and I'm turning. What I thought was gone is now returning.
Oh my God, or Look at Mary, which is a perfect Britpop song before Britpop happens in the 90s, or the original Britpop of Kinks and Beatles bands in the mid 60s.
All you want to know is what you found.
So, you know, David Roback leaves the Rain Parade early 1984. He goes on to do many other Paisley Underground-related projects, including, most successfully, Mazzy Star, which has this moment of success, circa the early alternative era. None of the Paisley Underground bands we're talking about today actually survive into the alternative era, although they are one of the many groups that help pave the way for it. You know, they all sign to a major label, they all don't sell millions of units, and they all break up. But they live on in terms of influence. Certainly, I think that's true of the Bangles. You know, there's really like two or three Bangles you can talk about.
That's true, Jim. And we're going to talk in depth about the Bangles and more Paisley Underground when we return on Sound Opinions.
And we are back. And this week, we're talking about the Paisley Underground, that slice of indie music in the early 1980s that drew inspiration from the psychedelic sounds of the 60s, but was all happening in the Reagan moment. Before the break, we were talking about the Dream Syndicate and Rain Parade. And now, Greg, you're going to talk about inarguably the most famous band hailing from the scene, the Bangles. Also, both of us think it's important to note that the Paisley Underground scene was not a boys-only club. Some of the most talented musicians, songwriters, and performers from that whole period were women.
And the Bangles were four very talented women who got together and wrote their own music and released their own music and became an integral part of the scene.
Killer songwriters.
Susanna Hoffs, the sisters Vicky and Debbie Peterson, they were the core of the band. They've really kind of been the consistent members through all the decades of this group. The bass players have changed over the years, but also women and also integral parts of the band were integrated into the songwriting, into the harmonies. You know, people say, well, what's the difference between what the Bangles were doing and, say, like the Mamas and Papas, which is a group I've heard them compared to. And I, you know, I love the Mamas and Papas, but there's so much here that's different about it. First of all, the songwriting in the band was top-notch early on. Those harmony vocals, yes,
There are some resemblance to some of those 60s vocal groups. Yeah.
The harmonies, it's a superficial comparison.
But the four singers in this group, and there were four singers in this group at all times, often changing lead vocalists on different tracks early on, especially. I'm emphasizing the early days because the story of this band is not a pleasant one when it comes to the corporate thumb being put on top of the band. But in those early days, they were writing some terrific songs with those great harmony vocals. I have to give a shout out to Vicki Peterson as a guitar player.
Oh, yeah.
She was just a genius in those sinewy guitar fills and riffs. It was about you're in and out in a few bars, but man, she said a lot in those few bars in every song. Their eponymous debut EP, soon after they renamed themselves the Bangles. They were originally known as the Bangs. It was released in 1982 and then reissued in 1983 by IRS Records, which back then was a pretty big deal.
Well, they're giving us REM, yes.
You know, original songwriting on that record, introducing the group. Unfortunately, that record was not available for a really long time. They sort of put it out, it floated out there, and you couldn't get it for decades. It finally was reissued as part of this compilation in 2014 of the Bangles / the Bangs' earliest music, which is wonderful. To me, if you want to find the roots of this band,
go to that EP.
That's the music right there.
It's such a tragedy, Greg. I mean, everybody, you know, all my students today and younger people today, the kids today, you know, everything's instantly accessible on Spotify. But one of the tragedies of these Paisley Underground bands is as fantastic as all these records were, there was a 15, 20-year stretch where you couldn't hear them.
Right.
Unless you were going to pay $50 at a snooty vintage vinyl store, you were not going to hear these records, including that EP or including the Rainy Day compilation.
Right. They had sort of been usurped by their own history. They got signed to Columbia Records, put out the All Over the Place record in 1984, which is still a good record.
That's a good record.
Produced by one David Kahn, who went on to do many, many things to many different bands over the years in terms of his production decisions. But this is a fairly good overview of what the band could do. There's 11 tracks on the record, 9 of them written by the band, which I think is key. When they brought together that sort of British Invasion meets West Coast folk rock sound with their original songwriting and those harmony vocals, they were a terrific, terrific band.
It is ironic. You were saying what great songwriters the Bangles are. It is ironic that people who know them, who aren't rock critic geeks like you and me, know Walk Like an Egyptian,
right?
Which they didn't write. They cover it.
Walk like an Egyptian. Walk like an Egyptian.
But there's also the originals like when Hero Takes the Fall and things like that.
Wasn't it me who said there'd be a price to pay and I won't feel bad at all when the hero takes the fall, when the hero takes the fall.
Dover Beach, you know, Tell Me. These are great songs on that first full length for Columbia. Then the Different Light record, that's the one that everybody knows, you know, from that era. 1986, 3 million selling record. Prince gave them Manic Monday.
It's just another Manic Monday. Wish it was Sunday. That's my fun day. I don't have to run day. It's just another Manic Monday.
He'd originally written that for Apollonia. He gives it to the Bangles. He had a thing for Susanna Hoff. She was enamored with that singer.
Well, Craig, we all did back then. Yes.
Manic Money's a huge hit. You mentioned Walk Like an Egyptian. That was originally penciled in for Tony Basil. And ends up being recorded by the Bengals. Again, David Kahn saying, hey, girls, what about this one, you know?
Yeah, well, they just become widgets in the machine. But listen, don't take our word for how influential and how great this movement was. When you say that Prince writes a song for the Bengals, he also signed the next band I'm going to talk about, the 3 O'Clock, to his record label. And what was the name of Prince's recording studio?
Paisley Park.
Paisley Park. He names it Paisley Park because he is enamored of the Paisley Underground moment. That is, he's at the height of his psychedelic Around the World in a Day moment, post-Purple Rain, you know, Raspberry Beret and all these songs. He's listening to what these younger kids are doing in a completely different genre in Los Angeles and loving it and trying to co-sign it. So the 3 O'Clock formed actually in that Southern California area in the suburbs. Michael Quercio is the leader of the band, and he's a really super sharp character, very enamored, you know, of 1966 Carnaby Street mod, you know. He's sort of a mod. And I think, again, those first two records, all of these bands are at their best right out of the gate. The Baroque Hoedown EP, and then the 16 Tambourines album. You know, there's a childlike naivete that is not there with the other Paisley Underground bands. It's very much akin to what Syd Barrett was doing in the early days of the Pink Floyd, where he's taking, you know, inspiration from Wind in the Willows, Mr. Toad, and writing a song about his cat, Lucifer Sam. And so there's that kind of childlike, wonderful naivete, which is part of the psychedelic moment. They signed to IRS. Arrive Without Traveling is still a pretty good record. By the time they get to Paisley Park, again, Paisley Park is Prince's label, and there's Warner Brothers distribution, and there's money involved. The pressure is on, and suddenly they become sort of a cartoon of themselves. But there really was a like youthful enthusiasm to the 3 O'Clock. Maybe just because Quercio always looked like he was 13 years old. You know, even today, I'm sure he's my age, but he still always looks like he's 13 years old.
And there's life to this scene yet, Jim. I think nostalgia, whatever you want to call it, there's still some vitality there. The Dream Syndicate have been reunited for a number of years and giving live performances, some of which that I have seen are quite good. But it's interesting that all four of these key bands that we just talked about have reunited, all with at least one original member.
Several original members, yeah. And they've done other things interesting in between. You know, Susanna Hoffs has made a couple of records with Matthew Sweet of, you know, power pop god. You know, they burst out of, as Vicki Peterson has said, it was like Paisley High, class of 83.
Mm-hmm.
They burst out with these fantastic records, each of which I will champion to this day. The first couple of albums by all of these bands and the early EPs. They get signed to the major label. They get thrown in the meat grinder and ruined to various degrees. And then they reemerge starting 2013, come back together and reconnect with that joy of making music now that there are no stakes, now that there are no major labels, now that there's no fortune to be made if you play by the rules of the machine. They're just making music for the joy of making music, and they still love this psychedelic ideal. I think one of the most inspiring records I've heard in recent years is this 3x4 compilation. What's the idea? The Bengals, the Dream Syndicate, the Rain Parade, and the 3 O'Clock all come together to play each of those bands one song by the other bands.
Mm-hmm.
All right? And what this does to me is underscore that this wasn't a fad. It wasn't about fashion. It wasn't the hot new thing, this Paisley Underground moment. It was about great songwriting. Because to hear, for example, the Rain Parade play As Real As Real by the 3 o'clock. Real World by the Bangles, or When You Smile by the Dream Syndicate, it highlights not only what was great about those songs by their friends and fellow travelers, it highlights what the Rain Parade's core sound was itself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I love that. It's like if you and me have a big fight and we don't talk for 25 more years, and then we get together and we fight again.
Well,
right? Because it's not just nostalgia. It's highlighting an aesthetic and the brilliance of these friends.
Well, and it's funny you should say that, because the Dream Syndicate covering Hero Takes a Fall by the Bangles,
yes,
which was ostensibly written by Susanna Hoffs about Steve Wynn and what a jerk he was back in those days. And Steve Wynn is now singing that song back to her.
Wasn't it me who said there'll be a price to pay and I won't feel sad at all when the hero takes a fall? When the hero takes a fall.
Going back and listening to all that early stuff for this segment, Jim, it revived my feelings about the genre as being well beyond its time. It wasn't just a period piece. You know, some of the later records are hard to listen to because they were so overproduced. But that early stuff by all of these bands really holds up.
You know, Greg, when we do these genre dissections, we always like to talk about how the influence is still present in music today. And I see the Paisley Underground. A lot of people consider it a retro movement linking back to the psychedelic moment of the 60s. But I think in retrospect, it's a lot like Screeching Weasel, the Chicago pop punk band. You know, the Ramones set the template. Screeching Weasel keeps it alive, and then Green Day and Blink 182 and a million other bands do it again a decade later. So, you know, you have the 60s innovators, and then you have the Paisley Underground revisiting that sound with a modern perspective. At the same time, there's a scene you love, the Dunedin sound, yeah?
Right, right. The whole New Zealand thing was very influenced by Paisley Underground and vice versa. I think those chiming guitar sounds that the New Zealand bands, like the Chills, for example.
As we were floating in a space capsule, I look at you, and perhaps you smile at me. Love in my mind is no more.
The Verlaines were very much in that same mode. I think they were coming from the same place, Jim.
Mm-hmm.
There were certain aspects of 60s music that they felt were well worth preserving and amplifying. First of all, just the primacy of the guitar in a rock band. In the 80s, that was under siege in the mainstream, you know.
It was all about synthesizers.
Everybody was playing with the new toys and the new technology. Nothing wrong with that. But guitars had sort of become passé in the mainstream. And I think these bands were basically saying, hey, wait a minute. There's still something really cool about these instruments. There is more to be said. And I think the other key, Jim, for me, in what unites the New Zealand scene to the Paisley Underground scene and what makes it so influential today, was a renewed emphasis on songwriting. You know, let's take the best of the 60s, which is A, guitars at the center of the rock band, but B, the craftsmanship, the melodies behind the songwriting.
Yeah, and I think that their love, the Paisley Band's love for those 60s sounds, obviously there are other groups at the same time besides New Zealand. The Teardrop Explodes, Julian Cope is very much in line, so is Echo and the Bunnymen.
Bring on the dancing horses, headless and all alone, shiver and say the words, every lie you've heard.
In Seattle, you have the Green Pajamas. People forget about them before the grunge moment. Prince, we've talked about, loving that sound. After the
moment ends. There are a number of splinter bands, Viva Saturn, the Continental Drifters, Mazzy Star, with members of the Paisley Underground. But then a new generation begins to crop up in the alternative moment, Mercury Rev.
Wanna ask, but I just stare. Can't I run my hands through your car wash hair?
Granddaddy. And you and I, we did a, you know, genre dissection of the shoegaze movement in England in the alternative era. Bands like My Bloody Valentine and Slow Dive.
Listen close.
There's no shoegazer band I've ever interviewed that didn't mention the Paisley Underground as pointing back to those 60s sounds. So really, any band in the psychedelic pop mode, you know, you hear it in power pop, you hear it in the shoegaze movement, you know, everybody loved those bands, you know, everybody being relative to people who like trippiness in their
right.
rock.
That wraps up our discussion of the Paisley Underground, and now we want to hear from you. What's your favorite band or song from the Paisley Underground? Leave us a message with your thoughts on our website, soundopinions.org. When we return, the history of the 1964 song Leader of the Pack on Sound Opinions.
And we are back. Nearly 60 years ago, the girl group The Shangri-Las came out with the unforgettable song Leader of the Pack, and one of our ace producers, Alex Claiborne, did one of my favorite feature segments ever on Sound Opinions about it.
For 1 week in 1964, The Shangri-Las sat atop the Billboard Hot 100 in front of legendary groups like The Supremes, The Rolling Stones, The Kinks, The Beach Boys, and while it stayed on the Hot 100 for only 12 weeks, the track's impact has extended far beyond 1964.
Absolutely, Greg. Written by Jeff Berry, Ellie Greenwich, and Shadow Morton, who produced the song, Leader of the Pack is pretty much the perfect blend of teen angst and pop exuberance. It also plays with the Shangri-La's signature melodramatic lyrics, you know, and the tough attitudes that endeared them to music fans and influenced a lot of artists who followed. I mean, Blondie, the New York Dolls, Amy Winehouse, even the Jesus and Mary Chain.
Author Ada Wolin writes about all of this in her book called Golden Hits of the Shangri-Las. Our producer Alex Claiborne spoke with her. They started the conversation by defining who the Shangri-Las were and how they stood out from their girl group contemporaries.
So the Shangri-Las actually consisted of two sets of sisters. So it was Mary and Betty Weiss, and Mary is who most people remember as the lead singer, and then two twins, Marge and Marianne Ganser. And they actually came from Queens, and they were just kind of a neighborhood group, and they were actually founded before they hooked up with a producer, which is kind of rare for most girl groups at the time. They started singing on the street corner, started singing in their neighborhood, even before they started singing what we would typically now think of as girl group music.
What I love about the Shangri-Las, and I think what you do really well in the book, you sort of crystallize all the articles that were written about them, all the music criticism, and all the books about the girl group era. And basically, they were sort of outsiders because they were very working class. They were kind of rough around the edges, and they are speaking at the beginning of the record in their Queens accents. They didn't hide the fact that they were from Queens and they were proud to be from Queens.
Is she really going out with him?
Well, there she is. Let's ask.
Betty, is that Jimmy's ring you're wearing?
Mm-hmm.
Gee, it must be great riding with him. Is he picking you up after school today?
Mm-mm.
By the way,
I think that one of the things that resonated so deeply with punk bands is that they were kind of, I don't know, they were a little off. They could sing, but they weren't really these kind of virtuosic singers that we think of as being real studio singers. And I think that's what people really liked, is that you had more personality in there. You got the feeling that these girls, even if they hadn't written the songs, they were really embodying these tough personas, and that wasn't just an act.
My folks were always putting him down,
down, down.
They said he came from the wrong side of town.
What do you mean when you say that he came from the wrong side of town?
Really, I think the legacy of Leader of the Pack is it's one of the foremost songs about teenage tragedy. And I was, you know, wondering at the time, how did people connect with it? I mean, it was very successful for them, obviously.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that this was so important for a girl group song in setting the tone of this bad boy archetype and the idea that the bad boy, you know, this was already a construct in film. We had James Dean, we had Marlon Brando, but to have actually from the perspective of the girls interacting with this and kind of flirting with rebellion. And I think especially for the Shangri-Las, you really got the feeling that this could be a part of their lives. This wasn't just someone wrote a song for them to sing to cash in on this rebellion kind of leather jacket thing. This was really, you could imagine them hanging out with this type of people, and it really sounded like it was embodying what it feels like to be a girl in the early to mid 60s, exploring with doing your own thing, rebelling against your parents, all of that.
I think sometimes people get hung up on sort of the melodramatic nature of the song because it's very tragic. You know, this young girl is dating this guy, and then he, you know, eventually gets in this horrible motorcycle accident, and there's a whole arc going on.
He's sort of small. He kissed me goodbye. The tears were beginning to show. As he drove away on that rainy night, I begged him to go slow. Whether he heard, I'll never know.
Sometimes I think people write that off as sort of young girl, teenage drama, but like you mentioned, there was a real air of authenticity with the song, and I think it gave them a little bit more oomph as opposed to maybe some of the other girl groups.
Absolutely, and I think that, as I say in the book, one of the things that's so interesting about the Shangri-Las is that they were not interested in this typical nuclear family. They were not interested in, today I'm going to meet the boy that I'm going to marry. They were living these lives that if it could be brilliant for a moment, that was good enough. And I think that that's something where that totally would be embodied in punk, because they really were interested in living fast. And if that meant dying young, that was part of the appeal. And I think that that is something that is so interesting, because you really don't see that in other female-fronted music of the era.
I felt so helpless. What could I do?
And really throughout their remaining lives, the four members, they sort of lived out some of the destinies in their songs. And can you talk a little bit about both the legal trouble the group had over the years, member changes, and also some of the members have since passed?
Yes. So it is very interesting to think about that so many of their songs were about dying young. Neither of the Ganser twins are living. You know, they lost one of them very early. I believe it was 1970. I think it was Marianne Ganser who died. And I think the only person who went on to make music was Mary Weiss, and she came out with an album in 2007. And it is interesting because, like many girl groups, they did not own the rights to their name. So in the 80s, another group was performing under their name, and that was something they really had no legal recourse against. And I think that is something that is so common. When you look into girl groups, often these producers own names, and they could do whatever they wanted with it.
The song Leader of the Pack was covered by a myriad of artists, and Twisted Sister put out a cover of the song. Bette Midler did her take on the song, and huge fans like the New York Dolls, Aerosmith doing some covers of their songs, and also Jesus and Mary Chain. When you think about it, what contemporary artist, who comes to mind that you think is sort of a descendant of the Shangri-Las?
That's a really good question. This is something that has come up, and I'm so hesitant of making the connection between, like, all girl music, like all young women make the same kind of music. But I do think that I actually saw a lot of influence in kind of the resurgence of garage, like surf rock about 5 years ago. And I noticed a lot of like female singers, which is something that had been, I felt, really lacking. You know, someone like Best Coast doing these songs that are kind of jangly in a particular way, where I was like, oh, this is exactly that kind of play on rock and roll and pop. And thinking about how can you have something be catchy and fun, but also be, you know, kind of driving in the way that rock and roll is.
Ultimately, it's friends telling stories to each other, and I think that's the core of why Leader of the Pack and much of the Shangri-La's music connected with people, and I think continues to connect with them.
Absolutely, and I think it's so interesting that it was so underproduced in a certain sense that you still got the feeling that, like, oh, this is a melodrama, this is teenager stuff. On one hand, they are written off as melodramatic, and that's a shame. But on the other hand, they also really played with that in a way that I think people are only just really beginning to understand. I think that the fact that they did have this kind of flamboyant persona is really part of the appeal, and it's part of what groups like the New York Dolls loved, is you could dress up and you could act out this tragedy. But at the same time, even though it was a melodrama or a play, it still hits you. It still tugs at the heartstrings.
Well, thank you so much, Ada, for chatting with me on Sound Opinions. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks so much, Alex.
That was our producer, Alex Claiborne, who should have been a member of the Shangri-Las, speaking with writer Ada Wolin about the band's Leader of the Pack. Greg, what do we have on the show next week?
Next week, Jim, it's the dawn of a new day. We're going to talk about songs about mourning. And, there's a million of them, and there are a million good ones.
There are a million good ones, and it's been on my mind because I got to go back to school.
You're going to be waking up early in the morning.
Yeah.
There you go. Don't forget to check out our bonus podcast feed wherever you get your podcasts.
The views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this program belong solely to Sound Opinions and not necessarily to Columbia College Chicago or our sponsors. Thanks, as always, to our Patreon supporters. Sound Opinions is produced by Andrew Gill, Alex Claiborne, and our associate producer, Sol Delgadillo. Our social media consultant is Katie Cott.